Welcome back to the Journal Review. This month we're working through the June 2026 issue of the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology. And I've got four pieces lined up for you: a surgical pearl out of the Emery Mohs Group, two Ethics Journal Club letters, and the first installment of a continuing medical education series on photodynamic therapy. Let's get into it. First up is a surgical pearl. So this is a short technique piece, not a study, no methods or results section to walk through, just a clinical problem and a fix. The problem here is one every Mohs surgeon has run into: thin xenografts. The group specifically calls out one called Oasis, are wonderful for covering wounds and coaxing along granulation tissue, but their thinness makes them maddening to actually place. They fold on themselves, they tear the moment you pass a needle through them, and they soak up wound fluid and lose structural integrity before you've even finished suturing. The fix the authors propose is disarmingly simple. Take a piece of petrolatum impregnated gauze, cut it to the size and shape of the defect first, then lay the xenograft on top of that gauze template and trim the xenograft to match. You end up with a xenograft gauze composite that you suture into the wound as a single unit, xenograft side down against the wound bed, gauze side facing up, using fast-absorbing gut suture. The rationale is straightforward. The gauze acts as a rigid enough scaffold to prevent folding and tearing during suturing. And because you're using fast-absorbing gut, both the gauze and the suture material slough off on their own after about 5 to 7 days of routine petrolatum wound care, leaving the xenograft seated in place without you having to return for a second procedure to remove anything. The practical takeaway here is squarely in the practice-changing for your workflow category. Even though it's a small thing, it's inexpensive, it uses supplies already sitting in your Mohs suite, and it directly addresses a technical annoyance rather than a theoretical one. If you use thin xenografts with any regularity, this is worth trying on your very next case. Next, two companion pieces from the Ethics Journal Club, both structured as advice column-style letters to Dr. Dermatoethicist. So again, no methods or data here. These are ethical analyses grounded in the literature and in professional guidelines rather than original research, and I'll treat them that way. The first asks about free skin cancer screening events and what obligation a department has once a suspicious lesion is found on someone with no clear route to follow-up care. The author's central point is that beneficence, finding the lesion, is only half the ethical equation. If there's no reliable pathway to biopsy and treatment afterward, you risk the opposite of your intent, generating anxiety, delaying care, and doing so disproportionately in uninsured and underinsured patients, which converts a non-maleficence and justice problem into a real one. The piece is blunt that free screening is not a substitute for actual coverage, and that screening programs need concrete infrastructure built in before they launch. Partnerships with federally qualified health centers or hospital charity programs for low-cost biopsy, patient navigators or community health workers to actually get people to follow-up visits, and teledermatology triage, where geography is the barrier. There's also a candid discussion of the conflict of interest optics when the screening dermatologist is also the one positioned to biopsy the lesion for a fee. The suggested remedy is transparency, offering patients a choice of provider and disclosing any financial relationship upfront. And there's a useful reality check buried in here for anyone running one of these events. Screening low-risk younger populations rarely turns up anything requiring urgent treatment, so targeting higher-risk patients, older age, heavy sun exposure history, immunosuppression, is both more ethical and more efficient than blanket community screening. Nothing here is practice-changing in a clinical sense, but if you or your department run or sponsor screening days, it's a genuinely useful checklist for building the follow-up infrastructure before you build the screening tent. The second ethics letter takes on a narrower and frankly more clinically relevant question for those of us doing full skin exams regularly. Should you offer an anogenital exam to an asymptomatic patient during a routine total body skin exam, even though they haven't raised it themselves? The piece cites survey data that's worth having in your head. In one study, the scalp gets examined by roughly 6 in 10 dermatologists, breasts by about a third, oral mucosa by around 1 in 7, and anogenital skin by less than 1 in 20. And within that already low anogenital number, male genitalia get examined far more often than female genitalia, about 1 in 4 versus 1 in 20. Set against that low examination rate, the stakes the authors cite are real. Pigmented vulvar lesions are present in roughly 1 in 10 women, and while vulvar melanoma is rare, it's aggressive and often caught late, with 5-year survival around 47%, compared to over 90% for cutaneous melanoma generally, a gap that's clinically enormous, even if the absolute incidence is low. The letter is honest that there's no dermatologic consensus here, and that major bodies split on it. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force says the evidence is insufficient to recommend routine total body exams, including genital inspection, while the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists actually recommends against routine pelvic exams in low-risk asymptomatic women in favor of shared decision-making. So the authors land where you'd expect an ethics piece to land, on autonomy plus beneficence, rather than a fixed rule. Their practical suggestion is a scripted, low-pressure offer, something like telling the patient you include the genital and anal area during skin checks because cancers can occur there, and asking if they're comfortable with that today, plus building the offer into rooming workflow so the patient has time to consider it before you walk in, rather than being surprised in the moment. For higher value scenarios, a personal history of melanoma, new pigmentation the patient has noticed, or explicit anxiety about completeness, they lean toward actively offering the exam. For genuinely low-risk asymptomatic patients, they consider omission ethically reasonable if discomfort outweighs expected benefit. Nothing here mandates a change to your consent process, but it's a nice framework for standardizing how you and your staff broach this, rather than leaving it to individual comfort level on a given day. Last and the meatiest piece this month is part one of a continuing medical education series reviewing photodynamic therapy. So this is a review article, walking through mechanism rather than reporting new data, and it's explicitly framed as a foundation for later installments that will cover clinical applications. Worth knowing the market context they open with, global photodynamic therapy revenue was around $4.5 billion in 2022 and is projected to nearly double by decade's end, which is the author's stated reason for revisiting the fundamentals now. The mechanism review starts with terminology worth having crisp in your head, even if you use this daily. A photosensitizer, most commonly 5-aminolevulinic acid or its ester, methylaminolevulinate, gets converted intracellularly into protoporphyrin 9 during the incubation period, and light of the appropriate wavelength then excites that molecule from its ground state into an unstable singlet state, which converts into a longer-lived triplet state. And it's that triplet state that has time to transfer energy either to surrounding substrates directly, generating free radicals in what's called a type 1 reaction, or, far more commonly, to molecular oxygen, generating singlet oxygen in what's called a type 2 reaction. The authors note their own prior work showing that 5-aminolevulinic acid with blue light significantly boosts superoxide reactive oxygen species, used as a surrogate marker for singlet oxygen generation, without generating measurable hydrogen peroxide or hydroxyl radical species, reinforcing that the type 2 singlet oxygen pathway is the dominant mechanism in the light sources most of us actually use. The reason this matters practically is the singlet oxygen half-life, about 40 nanoseconds, which limits its damage radius to roughly 20 nanometers. This is the biophysical basis for the selectivity that makes photodynamic therapy spare surrounding normal tissue. And it also explains why deeper or thicker lesions are harder to treat, since both light penetration and available oxygen fall off of depth. Downstream of that oxidative hit, the review walks through four distinct effects worth separating in your head. First, apoptosis, predominantly through the intrinsic mitochondrial pathway, with cytochrome C release and upregulation of the usual caspase and BCL2 family machinery, though an extrinsic FAS-mediated pathway contributes too. Necrosis can occur at higher doses, but is generally something protocols aim to minimize rather than exploit, given its nonspecific tissue damage. Second, vascular effects. Photosensitizer accumulates in endothelium and vascular membranes, driving endothelial apoptosis, vascular constriction, platelet aggregation, and eventual vessel occlusion, with measurable tissue damage appearing 1 to 2 days after treatment. This vascular shutdown mechanism is also the proposed basis for photodynamic therapy's efficacy against vascular lesions like port wine stains. Third, immune modulation. Damaged cells release damage-associated molecular patterns and activate complement, along with a cytokine cascade including interleukin-1 beta, interleukin-6, interleukin-12, and tumor necrosis factor alpha, recruiting dendritic cells, neutrophils, macrophages, and both cytotoxic and regulatory T cells into the field. And fourth, field and genetic remodeling effects. This is the piece that speaks most directly to field-directed treatment of cancerization. Beyond killing clinically visible lesional cells, photodynamic therapy appears to reprogram gene expression in the surrounding treated skin, downregulating proliferative and cancer-associated pathways, while upregulating keratinocyte differentiation markers and dermal matrix genes, an effect shown most robustly with methylaminolevulinate, but with similar trends emerging in 5-aminolevulinic acid with blue light. The review then pivots into photosensitizer classification. What makes an ideal photosensitizer? Selective uptake in diseased tissue, staying inert until light activated, rapid clearance afterward, before the excerpt available to us trails off into the specifics of 5-aminolevulinic acid and methylaminolevulinate, which will clearly be developed further later in the piece. As part one of a series, there's no results or limitations section to report here in the traditional sense. It's building vocabulary and mechanistic grounding for what the authors flag will be later installments on light sources and clinical protocols. The practical takeaway for now is really about precision and how you counsel patients and troubleshoot suboptimal responses. Understanding that you're dominantly driving a type 2 singlet oxygen short radius reaction helps explain why incubation time, lesion depth, and oxygen availability all move the needle on efficacy, and why thicker or hypoxic lesions underperform relative to thin, well-oxygenated field disease. Nothing practice-changing yet, but a solid refresher to have loaded before the clinical application installment lands. That wraps this month's rundown. A handy suturing trick for your fragile xenografts, two thoughtful ethics discussions worth revisiting the next time you're designing a screening event or standardizing your total body exam script, and a mechanistic refresher setting up what should be a more clinically actionable second half on photodynamic therapy. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next month.